Okay, I'm going to be talking about hydrocarbons today, pretty much just because that way other people can't, and I'm selfish and I want the easiest topic to myself. Basically, hydrocarbons are a compound made from hydrogen and carbon, obviously, by the name. They're...
Cut this bit out.
Usual compound, mostly carbon. It wouldn't be much of an issue, you know, you wouldn't devote a whole chapter to it, but hydrocarbons are important because... Screwed up the editing in this part, and it starts now. Carbon is a part of over 90% of all chemical compounds, and because life is carbon-based. We're all based from carbon, not from silicon, which I think we should be. I think it's possible, even if no one else does. Okay, on to the actual hydrocarbons and how you figure out what they are and name them. Basically, there's... Currently, that we've learnt about in chemistry, not sure if there's more, three different types of hydrocarbon, which are alkanes, alkenes, and alkynes. Alkanes are just basic hydrocarbons. You have the carbon, and you have as many hydrogen as will fit on, bonded to it. Alkenes are like alkanes, except one of the carbons is double bonded to another of the carbons, which means there can be, which means there are less hydrogens, there are two less hydrogens attached to it, because two of the bonds are being taken up by the carbons bonding to each other. This means you can't have only one carbon in it, alkene with only one carbon, because that wouldn't make sense, because there's nothing to bond it to. Same for alkynes. Alkynes are similar to the other two, except one of the carbons is triple bonded to another of the carbons, therefore having four less hydrogens than an equivalent alkane would have, minus methane, which only has one carbon, so you can't have methane or methine. Speaking of methane, I should probably explain how you get methane, how we name them. Okay, methane... And ethane and decane and nonane and what have you are named according to the amount of carbons and thus the amount of hydrogens they'd have. A hydrocarbon with only one carbon in it would be methane, not methane or methine, because with only one carbon there's no way for the carbons to be double bonded. But going from there, with two... What the suffix is, alkane, alkyne, whatever, is completely irrelevant, unless there's only one carbon, to how many carbons it is, and so I might as well explain how they're named. If there's only one carbon, it's methane, or methane, or methine. If there's two carbons, the prefix is eth, or eth. If there's four carbons, the prefix... Okay, I'll skip three. If there's three carbons, the prefix is bute. If there's four, the prefix is prop. If there's five, the prefix is pent. If there's six, the prefix is hex. You know, so on and so forth, up until however many they've named so far. The highest I know of is decane. Well, actually, centane would exist too. Oh, never mind. And so, you basically... To name it, you take what the prefix is, you know, on how many carbons there are, and so if there's five carbons, it'll obviously be pent, and for the last bit, if it's doesn't, if there are only single bonds, then it would become pentane. If there if two carbons are double bonded to each other, it would be pentene, and if there's a triple bond, it would be pentyne. And this was a way too long explanation on how to name hydrocarbons. Bye.
The relative atomic mass of an element is the average masses of all its isotopes. You get this by timesing the relative atomic isotopic mass of each isotope by the relative abundance percentage of that isotope and adding them all together. You then divide the result by 100 because... That takes it from a percentage down to the atomic mass.
I'm here to talk about metal properties and bonding. There are many different properties of metals, which include that they are good conductors of electricity, good conductors of heat. They are very malleable, which means they can be shaped. They are ductile, that means they can be drawn into a wire. They have a range of different melting and boiling temperatures. They have are generally high density and are very lustrous or reflective, which means they can be cut and polished very well, and they are often hard, but not all metals have these properties. Mercury, for example, is liquid at room temperature instead of solid. Metals are used in everyday life for structure, so buildings, bridges, and many other things. Their lightness and strength means they can be used for boats, cars, and vehicles of all sorts. And because they're also able to be made into wire, they are used in many different things, from dental braces to wire fencing to jewellery and electrical circuits at home. When talking about the properties and structures of metals, you usually come across the terms of delocalized electrons, ions or cations, and also the lattice formation. When talking about a delocalized electron, this refers to when metals are a part of a solid and the electrons around the nucleus or positively charged metal ions are moving around and intertwining with each other. When a metal loses an electron from its outer shell, it is called a cation or an ion. And a regular three-dimensional lattice is the arrangement of closely packed metal atoms, which helps give it its shape. When people modify metals, it means that they're adding two or more metals together to create better properties for the substance they want to use. For example, gold is popular for making jewellery, but it is very easily, when in pure form, very easily to be deformed and, for example, and is very soft. It is also added to another metal of sorts and is created a stronger type of gold that is used for jewellery, so it withstands longer. When mixing two metals together, it is called an alloy. When talking about metals, you also talk about work hardening and heat treatment. Work hardening and heat treatment is how you can change the properties and structure of a metal so to create a stronger or more brittle substance. Work hardening is when the metal is beaten and worked when cold in to rearrange the crystal grains of the metal, creating hardness. Whereas heat treatment, there are three different ways of doing this. Annealing is when the metal is heated to a moderate temperature and then left to cool slowly. It allows larger crystals to form and metal produces softer and more ductile. Quenching involves the metal to heat to a moderate temperature and then quickly quenched or cooled in water to form tiny crystals. This makes the metal harder but much more brittle. Tempering is when when quenched metals are warmed again but to a lower temperature. This reduces the brittleness of the material while retaining the hardness. Metal crystals are the arrangement of particles within a metal which give it its shape and structure. When there is a disruption between the crystals, there is more likeliness for being very brittle. If it's very parallel and organized, it is much stronger. The final arrangement of the crystals will affect the extent of the metal's malleability and brittleness, and also its life expectancy.
Periodic table. One of the greatest arrangements of elements made. I'm going to talk to you about the periodic table made by Mendeleev and how it was made and what is in it. The periodic table contains all the elements known to man, and they're arranged in different blocks. Firstly, you have your S block, which is group 1, alkali metals. And group 2, alkali earth metals. These elements have half-filled or full S subshells as the highest energy subshells. Then you got your P block, which contains elements in groups 13 to 18. A P subshell is the highest energy subshell of the element in this section. After that, you got your elements in the S and P block.
which was what I was talking about before. These are usually the elements referred to as the main group of elements. You got your D block, which contains the elements known as transition metals, which are located on the S and P blocks, between the S and P blocks, sorry, and contains elements in which there are 5 orbitals, the little circle things around the nucleus, with a maximum of 10 electrons on the further shell. Then you got your F block, which contains the lanthanides, that's spelled L-A-N-T-H-A-N-I-D-E-S, and actinides, spelled A-C-T-I-N-I-D-E-S. They're set of 14 elements with atomic numbers from 58 to 71. That was the lanthanides, and the actinides have atomic numbers 90 to 103.
Who was Mendeleev? Yeah.
Mendeleev was the guy that discovered the periodic table and arranged them. As he looked at chemical elements and arranged them in order of increasing atomic mass, he saw that they had similar properties but different. Okay, I'm going to tell you about the period. It's period 1 is hydrogen, period 2 is the row under that, period 3 under that, and so on. It goes to period 7. Now the group that goes from hydrogen again, well, lithium you could say, to 18, which was 1, lithium 1, to 18, which is helium.
Yep.
In a periodic table, there are various trends. Various trends.
Another way to measure the amount of substance, you might find out the amount of substance in small and mol. The formula divides the number of particles by Avogadro's number of particles. And if you want to find out the number of particles, a big M, large is the amount of substance times the amount of substance by Avogadro's number. For example, if I had 5 moles of hydrogen atoms, and I wanted to work out the number of particles, I would times 5 by Avogadro's number. This would give me 3 times 10 to the 24 atoms in hydrogen.
As people were still searching for different elements at the end of the 19th century, evidence for the existence of particles even smaller than atoms accumulated. Dun, dun, dun.
Well, now I shall talk about an early atomic model were carried out because atoms in which we see, even with the most powerful electrons, chemists used models to represent them. These models change with time as chemists learn more about the particles to take up atoms.
And the glass on the wall opposite the negative electrode.
In 1897, Thomson took the latest experimental evidence for the existence of positive matter and negative particles and proposed an atomic model. Imagine the atom to consist of a sphere of positive matter in which negative particles were embedded randomly like plums in a pudding. It's a funny one. This became known as Thomson's plum pudding model, funnily enough. Thomson's plum pudding model replaced that of Dalton, who had likened an atom to a very small solid ball of matter. By 1900, it was accepted that atoms contain positively charged particles called protons, and much smaller negatively charged particles called electrons. Dun, dun, dun. Yeah, we'll talk about that. Very good bloke. Oh. I never really met him, but
his research team
always heard about him touching.
The path of the alpha particles determined by studies
experimentation by
Rutherford and New Zealand placed behind the metal, while most of the high energy particles
produced results that could not be explained by Thomson's model.
Rutherford's work was amazed to the model that about the atom, 1 in 8,000 particles was detected.
Rutherford was awarded the Nobel Prize for Chemistry in
1981. Anyway, I remember that. Great time in our life. For his investigations into disintegration of the elements and the chemistry of radioactive substances.
He fired a 16-inch shell at a piece of tissue paper. Yeah. I don't know why that would be incredible, but, you know, he did. And it came back at you.
Rutherford concluded that for such a large proportion of the alpha particles to pass through the gold foil, most of the volume of an atom must be empty space. He suggested that the small proportion of alpha particles that bounce back were repelled by the positive matter identified by earlier physicists. Yeah. Good old Rufy. That's what we used to call him. Yeah. I'll talk to you a bit about the discovery of the neutron. It took until about, top of my head, about 1932 for James Chadwick to identify the particle that was uncharged and had a mass a little greater than that of a proton. good old Chaddy is what we call him. We called him Chaddy. Yeah, discovered the neutron. Good day. He called the particles neutrons and reasoned that the nucleus of atoms must contain neutrons as well as protons. Thus, a helium atom, which is 4 times heavier than a hydrogen atom, contains 2 protons and 2 neutrons in the nucleus. With the discovery of the neutrons, scientists had identified 3 subatomic particles that allowed them to identify individual atoms. The discovery of the neutron also explained a problem faced by Rutherford some years earlier. So, like, good old Chaddy just, like, showed up Ruthie. In working with the element thorium, Rutherford had identified a radioactive material which is chemically similar to thorium. He called this material thorium X. I don't know why, just, you know, random name. Other chemists found similar substances for the elements of the periodic table between lead and uranium. At the time, although no simple explanation was available, the British scientist Frederick Soddy, I remember Freddo, that's what we called him, Freddo, he's a good bloke, like, funny ass guy, decided to place similar substances such as thorium X, you know, in the same position in the periodic table. He suggested that varieties of particular elements existed and called these varieties isotopes. In Greek, because I used to learn Greek, it means same place. That's what it means. Then Chaddy, that's what we used to call him, formerly known as James Chadwick, could now explain the existence of isotopes. Isotopes of an element have the same number of protons and electrons, but differ in number of neutrons present in the atom. That's about it from me. Hope you've learned a bit about the atomic theory. And, you know, peace out.
Inorganic compounds, such as crockery and table salt and rocks, they all have common characteristics, such as having a high melting and boiling temperatures. They are hard but brittle. They also do not conduct electricity in a solid state, but they do conduct electricity if they are melted or dissolved in water. From these properties, we can make the following deductions about the particles present in solid sodium chloride. The forces between the particles are strong. There are no free-moving electrons present, unlike in metals. There are charged particles present, but in the solid state, they are not free to move. When an ionic compound melts, however, the particles are free to move and then the compound will conduct electricity. The ionic bonding model. Chemists believe that when metallic and non-metallic atoms react to form ionic compounds, the following steps occur. Metal atoms lose electrons to non-metallic atoms and so become positively charged metal ions. Non-metal atoms gain electrons from metal atoms and so become negatively charged non-metal ions. Large numbers of positive and negative ions formed in this way, then combined to form a three-dimensional lattice. The three-dimensional lattice is held together strongly by electrostatic forces of attraction between the positive and negative ions. The electrostatic force of attraction holding the ions together is called ionic bonding.